The Tom Woods Show, episode 1021.
Prepare to set fire to the index card of allowable opinion. Your daily dose of liberty education starts here. The Tom Woods Show.
Men, it's time to say goodbye to those $99 suits on the clearance rack. This week, my listeners can get any premium Indochino suit for just $379 at Indochino.com when entering Woods at checkout. Hey everybody, Tom Woods here, talking today with Gene Epstein about the most recent winner of the Nobel Prize in Economics, Richard Thaler. And there's a lot to say here. He's done a great deal of work in so-called behavioral economics, and we're going to talk about what, if anything, we can draw from his work that is of value to us and what we might criticize. Of course, Gene Epstein is economics and book review editor at Barron's, the nation's premier financial publication, and he joins me now. Gene, thanks for being here.
Tom, nice to be back. And you, of course, are on a roll. It must be dizzying these days for you since your 1,000th episode got postponed. And it's all come at the same time that I saw you in New York for the day, for the weekend about Murray Rothbard. And now you're off on your cruise. And you're not even 45 years old yet, right?
I'm barely 45.
Barely 45.
Yeah.
So I'm turning 73 in November, and I'm still going strong. So you've got at least, 28 years to go, they're very lucky for us all. And I got a chance to talk to Bob Murphy at the commemoration of Rothbard about his appearing on my Soho Forum to do a very juicy debating topic that will happen. And by the way, I think that the greatest part of that evening, which I'm sure you were there to see, was Hans Herman Hoppe's speech commemorating his involvement with Rothbard that made us all pretty envious. I'm wondering if you should share that with your listeners. It was quite something what he had to say, quite moving and unforgettable.
Yeah, it was a great speech. It was a brilliant speech. It's a speech only he could have given.
Yeah,
and
absolutely.
I probably shouldn't say something that I won't mention the person's name, but let's just say somebody you and I both know at the end of the talk and the next day wrote to Hans to say that was the single best after dinner speech I have ever heard. I did not want it to end. It was quite good.
Absolutely. I could have written that myself. Of course, in a way, my most unforgettable moment was when Hans said with his usual sort of intensity is that there is no Rothbard, not even close. He told us all, but collectively, maybe we make up for that, for the fact that there is no Rothbard around anymore.
Oh, yeah, these days. Right. And I liked his offhand remark about he's worked on his personal lovability over the years.
No, he made that joke in one of his essays when he was talking about public goods that I work on my, he likes to use that joke, I work on my personal lovability, which is a very important public good that I spread around.
That's right.
He'd already used that great joke, worth using again.
Yeah, and look, he's managed to accomplish that without public subsidy.
Yeah.
Right? Even though it is a public good. All right.
That's right. You should make that point.
Let's talk about the recent announcement of the Nobel Prize in Economics.
Sure,
and
sure.
In particular, you've just written a column in which you admit that in 1999, you hereby nominated this year's winner for the prize,
yeah.
And now you're not so sure about that. So who's the winner, and why were you nominating him in 1999?
Good question, and this gives me the opportunity to put that in context. I didn't have room in my column. I didn't want to write more than 1,000 words, given everybody's short attention span. But by 1999, I'd been a columnist starting in '92 for Barron's. I'd been periodically belittling the Nobel Prize winners. Here's a funny Rothbard story, by the way. It was in September of '92, when Gary Becker won the award. And I called Rothbard up in Las Vegas. He was at the University of Nevada, Las Vegas. asked him what he thought and of the award. And interestingly, I guess Rothbard might have thought that I was like a semi-establishment. So he began by saying very politely and courteously to me, well, it's very nice that a free market guy from Chicago, you know, gets the award. And I cut in and I said, what do you think about Becker's idea that a family is like a firm? And Rothbard said, I think it's nuts. You know, you give that great squeaky voice. And that, and indeed, I mentioned to Rothbard, you could just as well speculate that a firm is like a family. And year after year, I was giving you know, a couple of Bronx cheers to the Nobel Prize winners. So readers were asking me, well, you know, who's your nominee for the Nobel Prize? By I guess this started after Rothbard tragically died in 1995. I would have nominated him for sure. But then, so by 1999, I said, okay, look, here's a guy. I like his stuff. And I stipulated in that same column that I've come to realize that the Nobel Prize is sort of like the Swedish equivalent of Oscar night. So I'm not going to take it too seriously. But this guy has at least a few interesting things to say, which we could discuss. So why not give him the Nobel? So that was my context. So I then proceeded to point out that, you know, he had some insights. And since 1999, his insights began to take on a certain amount of statist baggage, already showing signs of that in 1999. But that was what I wanted to object to, while also saying that, you know, I'm consistent. If this is just the Oscar for the dismal science, why not give it to Richard Thaler? Now, the Swedish Academy of Sciences spoke about his achievement. He explored the consequences of limited rationality, social preferences, and lack of self-control in markets. And I do indeed think that there is limited rationality, social preferences, and lack of self-control in markets, in human action. And I would say as well that that's not news to the Austrians. But Thaler put a little bit more meat on those bones, and for that, I commend him. So maybe I should stop there and see what your reaction is.
Well, let's say a little something about the whole matter of nudging, because he co-authored that famous book, Nudge, and I'm interested in your analysis of this. There was actually a pretty good article on this in the New York Post a few days ago, reviewing a New York policy that was kind of designed to gently nudge people into making less self-destructive decisions, and it had fairly limited results. I'll get to that a little bit later. But what's meant by this idea of nudging people?
That's, of course, the core of the point. The problem I have with Thaler and his collaborator, Cass Sunstein, Harvard law professor Cass Sunstein. Thaler, in 2010, consulted with the British government about getting the government to do nudging, which I will define, and Sunstein worked for the Obama administration. But by the way, should emphasize, as I mentioned briefly at the end of the column, that there's no way for libertarians, and by the way, here's the irony, Sunstein and Thaler specifically call themselves libertarians. We'll get to that. But there's no way for libertarians to object to the idea that a private company or nonprofit might want to nudge people. A nudge, according to Thaler and Sunstein, does not violate libertarian principles because it's just a nudge. Here's an example that they like to use. When you're deciding as an employee if you want to adopt a 401k plan and allocate money for savings, then the nudge idea would be that unless you say that you don't want to, you are automatically enrolled. In other words, that's just a nudge, because you could say you don't want to, and that means that's libertarian paternalism, as they like to put it. And then they claim that there's nothing wrong with that. And I would agree that there is nothing wrong. There's no way for me to object if the private firm I work for, News Corp, wants to nudge me in that way into doing a 401k plan. That's their decision. They administer my situation. If I want to object, I can speak out. If I want, if I hate it so much, I'm free to resign from this company. There's no way for us to object. Where I think that they are being woefully naive is in saying that the government has the right to do that, that they can trust, we can trust the government to nudge us in that way. And my first, of course, obvious objection, which Fowler has to be reminded about, and indeed so many of the mainstream have to be reminded about, is that when we talk about irrationality, what the Swedish committee talks about, limited rationality, social preferences, and lack of self-control, since people run the government, those people who run the government are not at all exempt from those faults as well. And so just for starters, the idea that we can trust them to administer to our lives and have the power of government to nudge us in the directions that they think are best is obviously woefully irrational and naive. When it comes to saving decisions, the government is, federal government is, of course, the most profligate institution of all. It's deeply in debt. It can't possibly meet its unfunded liabilities that have been promised to the baby boomers or promised to the millennials. It's the counterpart of the most profligate relative you can possibly know. And so the idea that the government is going to nudge us in one direction or another in that case is, of course, absurd. I also use the example of state-run lotteries. The government pretends that you have as a better chance of winning the lottery as you than you have of being hit by lightning. They are fanning the flames of irrationality because of their greed for a revenue. They're preying on naive people who think that you have if you buy a lottery ticket, you have a decent chance of winning. Again, you have a much better chance of getting run over tomorrow morning by a car. And so the idea that these irrational institutions in state and local and federal government should nudge us in any way is, of course, crazy. And the reason they are so profligate is that they uniquely do not bear the responsibilities for the financial consequences of their own decision. Private sector companies do. Nonprofits do. But they of course, can kick the can down the road for decades. And then we can talk about the ignorance problem. I didn't even mention that. The social norms that determine government means they can persuade us to eat certain foods that they think are right, but then usually there are special interests that establish these norms. They're often leading us down the wrong road. But more importantly, of course, fundamentally, there's the corruption of power. And that once you give government the right to nudge you, then power will corrupt. And that nudge could turn into a coercion, into a knock. And indeed, Fowler was always already flirting with nudges and knocks even back in 1999. So that's my fundamental problem with the idea of nudging as careful. And again, Fowler and Sunstein will want to engage us on this. They want to say, oh, no, we are libertarians. But unfortunately, we have to politely say that, please draw the line. Please understand that you can't get the government into this business of nudging us. There are far too many dangers in that.
All right. We're going to talk further about this. In particular, there's a really fundamental Austrian critique of this whole approach that I want to make in just a minute after we thank our sponsor. All right. I think we all know in the abstract that if you want to look your best, you want to have a made-to-measure suit instead of one you just pick up off the rack. But you think, well, what am I, a millionaire? I can't afford a suit like that. But you can with Indochino. $379 for a made-to-measure suit, and it's easy to do. You can measure yourself very easily. They show you exactly how to do it to get the size measurements they need to give you the suit that will fit you best. In fact, you can customize your suit. You can choose from hundreds of top quality fabrics, personalize it just the way you want it, including lapels and pleats and jacket linings and all kinds of things. I found it easy and very user-friendly to place an order at Indochino.com. Well, this week, my listeners can get any premium Indochino suit for just $379 at Indochino.com when entering Woods at checkout. That's 50% off the regular price for a made-to-measure premium suit, plus free shipping. So that's Indochino.com using promo code Woods for any premium suit for just $379 and free shipping. That's an amazing deal for a suit that'll fit you better than anything off the rack ever could. So check it out at Indochino.com, promo code Woods. All right, Gene, before we get into some other considerations here, I want to just share with you a couple of items from this New York Post column I was telling you about. Yeah. I'll link to this. The show notes page is tomwoods.com/1021. But anyway, what Kyle Smith is saying in here is that Mike Bloomberg dreamed up something called the Opportunity NYC Family Rewards Program, and it was funded privately, and it was intended to break down poverty by giving cash incentives to low-income New Yorkers to basically do sensible things. And so it turns out that the results were simply very, very minimal. Mm-hmm. And so he says, just to give an example, he says, from 2008, we had this classic Bloomberg-era style nudge whereby we put calorie counts on menus.
Yeah.
And so if we look at the calories, we'll say, there's no way I'm going to eat this bloomin' onion at Outback Steakhouse. I'm going to go have a beet salad. And it turns out that that did not happen. The New York Times even reported, at no time did the labels lead to a reduction in the calories of what diners ordered. So then, for example, it was things like, this is somebody who was in the program recalling it, you'd get $50 to go to the library. You'd get $300 every 2 months if you showed them a pay stub that showed you'd been working. If you passed the SATs or graduated from high school, you got rewards. But as I say, the results seem to have been fairly modest. So it says some high school students saw an uptick in attendance and scores, but not the kids most at risk. Elementary and middle school students who participated made no educational or attendance gains. The main effect of the program was that it steered an average of $6,000 a year to the families that participated. And so one mother said this, "I already steered my children to do the right thing. It did help me financially. My children were able to wear nice shoes and nice coats. We went on vacation." Okay, I don't think that was what the point of the program was. So, okay, so we have that. We have that they don't really seem to have much to show for them. But the other thing is more fundamental. When you look at these behavioral economists and people who want to nudge people, what they're saying is that, you know, the problem is people behave, quote, irrationally. They behave in ways that surprise economists. They behave in ways they shouldn't behave. But that's not the Austrian understanding of how people behave, because we don't do behavioral economics. Austrian economics is a purely logical approach to the implications of choice. We don't look into why people make the choices they do. We don't. When we say human action is purposeful, it's goal oriented. To say that it's rational, we would define rational quite differently. Whereas in this case, we have an economist who says people are predictably irrational. And the New York Times gives these examples, that they won't pay more for an umbrella during a rainstorm, or they'll buy a coffee mug for $3 but refuse to sell it for $6. First of all, I don't see why that's not irrational. It's just people have valuations that apparently are different from those who want to stand outside them and judge them. There's nothing wrong with that. The point of economics is to look at people's given goals and understand how, you know, the process whereby they go about satisfying them. It's not to stand in judgment of their goals or to smack them around or to claim these people are impossible to understand. Psychology has nothing to do with this. Yeah. But that's, it seems to me, that's what they're trying to do.
I think that your point is fundamentally right. Let me go back to Bloomberg, by the way. It's kind of interesting. I know you said $50 to go to the library. I mean, of course, Bloomberg was not just a nudger, as you probably know. You know, when he wanted to outlaw smoking in bars, my proposal at the time was, just look, Mayor Bloomberg, you're a billionaire. Open up a series of Bloomberg bars, and the sign will say outside, "No smoking allowed in the Bloomberg bars." And if people want to go to those bars where no smoking is allowed, then they will do so. But some people, you know, some people like to smoke, and others who are non-smokers might just as well go to the bars where smoking is allowed. So he was not just a nudger. He was the perfect example of a power-hungry guy who clearly didn't just believe in nudging. He believed in knocking. And, I mean, there's the information problem. By the way, I lost 25 pounds on a low-carb diet. I know you've had you had Nina Teicholz on about that. I don't count calories. I count carbs. And so the idea that one should count calories, that calories are of interest to me, is absurd. Again, that's just nonsense that the government happens to believe, in my opinion, because they're wrong about nutrition. But getting back to your point, I think you formulated it in a fundamentally valid way. You know, there was an example. I'm trying to remember how I came across who originally introduced it to me. But there was a point made about the difference between the Austrian school and the Chicago school. Of course, the fundamental difference is, of course, the differences over the role of money in the central bank. But variety example is in terms of the difference between the two is you're driving cross country and you stop in a town and you have a wonderful lunch, great food, fantastic service, and you leave a large tip because you think it was such a great experience. Now, your chances of actually encountering those people in that town again are maybe one in a million, encountering maybe one in a trillion. So clearly, there's nothing in it for you. There's no gain to be had from leaving that tip. It's simply a gesture that you wanted to do because you liked what these people did for you. And the point is, the point was that the Chicago school would not understand that kind of behavior. The Austrian school has no trouble with it because people have goals and purposes. You simply may simply want to leave a large thank you to somebody who did you a good turn, whom you may never, probably will never see again. And indeed, broadly speaking, I think that's valid. And if what you just said, but if we look at Thaler's many examples, we can say that, well, he is describing human behavior in a valid way. I'll give you another example. Rothbard, when Rothbard was talking about the difference between small business and corporations at one point, he gave the example of a small businessman who gives his deadbeat brother-in-law a job in the business in order to buy peace in the family. You know, and again, that's not profit maximizing. It puts you business at risk. You have to have an edge in the market in order to survive that, but that's what people do. And so the huge range of human emotion, of huge human action is, of course, accommodated, just as you indicate, in the Austrian view, and is not accommodated in the Chicago school view. And of course, Thaler is a professor at the University of Chicago, although in the business school. So he's a little bit hung up on that point. But I would still, but here's where I guess I might depart from you a little bit. I would still say that there are occasional nudges. Again, we can't object to nudges that a private sector group wants to do. We do know as well that retailers, that businesses are looking for ways to affect our behavior by nudging us in different ways. And that isn't, of course, necessarily against our self-interest. But at least they make a limited point, which is that when a company gives you the default option, which is that unless you say you don't want the 401k, you're going to get it, they do find that when people are informed about it, they don't change back. They sort of want to save. So I don't think we should deny that to some degree we are a little ambivalent about working strictly in what we might often say as our self-interest, that we do want to save, but we have other temptations and other things that mean that we don't. So while I wouldn't stress the point, and I would indeed agree with you that the Austrian school is marching to a different drummer, has different core ideas. I think that when Thaler introduces these stories, that we can acknowledge that human behavior is idiosyncratic, and that it doesn't trouble us in any way, and that market participants may want to alter human behavior in different ways through nudging, and that's their right to do so, so long as we leave the state out of it. So in that sense, I would offer a modification to your point of view, where I would say that when Thaler talks about the range of experience and the range of behavior and the idea of mental accounting, I mean, the other example that I gave in my column was a friend of mine who was carrying credit card debt, paying double-digit rates on his credit card debt, and he had more than enough money in a savings account, earning a single-digit rate, to wipe out the credit card debt. He admitted that it was costing him to do this, but he didn't want to do it because he was booking his savings account as wealth. And by the way, Thaler, when I once spoke with him about it, Thaler said that there may be nothing wrong with that. When people have certain kinds of mental accounting that enable them to discipline themselves, the guy wanted to hold on to a savings account, and he was willing to pay a price by paying off the credit card debt for a while. Thaler said that isn't, by the way, he conceded, that isn't necessarily fundamentally against that person's wishes. It was just, on the surface, it seemed irrational. So in a way, Thaler gave ground and understood that this kind of behavior is not necessarily inconsistent with our purposes. So in that sense, I do want to argue that there's nothing in Thaler's anecdotes and series of insights about mental accounting that necessarily hurts us or disturbs the Austrian view. I mean, the other one, by the way, is the way we frame things, that when you spend, $25,000 on a new car, the salesman knows that you have a certain framework and that you'll buy the extra features. It certainly won't feel like much if you buy, pay $1,000 extra for better tires or $1,000 extra for this or that. I mean, that's the way we proceed. And so again, nothing wrong with that. That's all human behavior. And I think it's all fascinating. And at the end of the day, I would argue that it's totally compatible with the Austrian view. And it's only incompatible with a very narrow Chicago school view.
Okay, but let's think of it this way.
Okay.
On the one hand, he's saying, look, this paradigm whereby we assume that actors behave in ways that we would consider narrowly rational is clearly incomplete as a way of understanding human beings.
Right.
But then he turns around and basically says, they should be acting that way. So in other words, he takes it as a paradigm that ought to inform our actions. So he's not breaking with it. He's saying, yeah, look, people don't act like little robots, but doggone it, they should.
So,
and that's basically what Mario Rizzo says. I'll link to his comments as well. In fact, let me, if I may just read a couple, just a little bit from Mario Rizzo from NYU.
Okay.
He says, behavioral economics remains wedded to this narrow conception of rationality as a normative and prescriptive standard of evaluation. It drives the critique of many market outcomes and is the basis of policy prescriptions. It is precisely because people are not narrowly rational that, the behavioral economist says, their behavior must be fixed. Their behavior must be taxed, regulated, or nudged in the direction of the behavior of the perfectly rational neoclassical man. So on the one hand, they say, oh, this neoclassical man is a fiction, but we got to make people be like that man. So then Rizzo says, for example, it is alleged that people are obese because they fail to take, quote, full account of the negative effects of their unhealthful eating habits. What is full account? They must reckon or discount these effects at the rational rate of discount, the long run rate, the rate one would use if one were super rational and calm in making a diet plan to be implemented in, say, 6 months or a year. But how the agent looks at things now, at the moment of deciding what to eat, is wrong. It is impetuous. It is present biased. The individual needs help, and in practice, it is the government's help. And then finally, he says, aside from the policy implications, there is an incredible irony here. Standard economics is mocked for its rationality assumptions, and yet those assumptions are held up as an ideal for real human beings. And these are my favorite three lines.
Yeah.
It is as if there is a neoclassical man deep in each of us, struggling to get out, but he is continually bombarded by behavioral shocks. Behavioral policy is about nothing less than becoming the real you. All this despite your resistance. I think that's well said.
Well said. Let me give you another example, Tom, and then generalize from it to make a sort of related point. You did a great interview with David Henderson about the idea of gouging of high prices at times of stress, hurricanes, and so on. And I'm trying to remember whether you went into this point, which I think is empirically valid, which is that this is a point that Fowler made. And interestingly, this is where, again, Fowler, I think, is torn, and he is, with part of him, he's willing to talk like an Austrian. What he said was that empirically you find that in the event of a snowstorm, a hardware store that's been around for years will tend not to hike the price of the snow shovels. And that what they will do, they will undermine their own customers by allowing the shovels to be sold out right away so that they don't allow the price to rise so that the price rations who really needs that shovel. You know, some people may be coming in and buying a second shovel. He'll say, empirically, it's just that because of reputation, because there are certain people, too many of the customers are going to think they're being mean-spirited and benefiting from this reversal of 2 feet of snow on the ground, so they won't raise the price of the shovels. But Fowler said, but people on the street or for one-time events, the price will clear. In other words, you and I might come in, we might charge $20 a shovel. We're one-time businesses, and we will charge $20 a shovel. My point is that Fowler is describing patterns of behavior that he agrees are not irrational. I'm only saying that with part of what Fowler has said, he really agrees with us and with Rizzo. He's only talking about the quirks of behavior and getting back. And I think, by the way, he's right that he said special events, theaters, by the way, it's an interesting point about whether theaters, what should theaters charge when prices rise. But Fowler shows there's a tendency for companies and stores that have been in business for a long time not to have a reputation for hiking the price. So they will do what seems to be irrational. However, as Fowler said, unfortunately, the customers are not going to like what they do. They're going to think they're being predatory, and so they don't hike the price. They don't. And so that is technically irrational, but obviously it's fundamentally rational because they have to stay in business and they want to please their customers. But one-timers can do it. One-timers can bring it in, can raise the price. And so I think you would agree that that's probably about right, the way behavior is, the patterns of behavior. It at least it describes a certain kind of behavior about the shovels not rising in price, but somebody selling them on the street corner and bringing them and charging what the market will bear. And bear in mind that Fowler is saying that's human action. So what I'm trying to argue is that there are different kinds of Fowler because he is ambivalent. He is torn. He calls himself a libertarian. He tries to dance around the issue and tries to say that this is libertarian paternalism. I would say, by the way, that another question. If you run a company, you want to you can be a paternalist. The Koch brothers, a lot of libertarian entrepreneurs are very caring about their employees and they think in terms of trying to shape human behavior in ways they think are good. So nothing wrong with their saying, well, we're going to declare that you have to tell us you don't want to save in order and don't want to do a 401k. So that's the default option. So that can happen. And so they can do it. And that's all human action. And there's nothing wrong with that. So I'm only trying to create space and trying to say to the point you made, quoting Rizzo, there is indeed the temptations on Ballers and Sunstein's part to start consulting with government, to start, they themselves are power hungry. I'm only trying, at the end of the day, to try to take a part of this analysis, a part of what they're talking about, which does describe human behavior and the quirks of human behavior, and trying to say that up to a point, it's simply human action. And again, emphasizing that Fowler, in his saner moments, both in his writing, by the way, about the shovels in the snowstorm and in conversation with me basically says that he's not saying that people are fundamentally irrational. He's only talking about the quirks of human behavior, which I think are interesting. So at the end of the day, we agree, except I would say there's a piece of Thaler that's perfectly compatible with Austrian economics. While I insist that, and again, I agree with you completely, that there's the knowledge problem, there's the corruption problem, there's the fact that if he wants to say that people are crazy, the government is crazier, and all of that I think is also true, and that's why I would want to keep government out of it. So I think we're about 99% in accord with each other, and we needn't fight over that last 1%.
No, that's true. Although fighting over the 1% is half of what
important.
I do. But I guess I'll say that some of the kinds of examples that somebody like this might raise to say, like, for example, I've used this example too. In fact, I think I used it in a follow-up episode where precisely the case of a movie theater and a big movie comes out one night and everybody wants to go see it. They could jack the price up to try to make the market clear. Because if we were just looking at a textbook, that would seem to be the thing to do, but they would lose a lot of customer goodwill. And so they wind up not doing that because as you say, if they were a one-time shop driving down the street and they were going to show one movie and you'd never see them again, they could maybe do that.
That's
but they
right.
feel like their long run reputation requires them to keep the prices where they are. And some people walk away disappointed. They'd rather have that. I find these, these are interesting examples of, and that just makes me want to not look at the, and maybe I'm being unfair to him, I realize, but not look at the market as, Jesus, why doesn't it work the way I want it to? Rather try to understand why it does work the way it does. What is motivated? Why is this happening this way? Or for example, a lot of times when we hear about deflation, and we say the problem with deflation is that prices don't adjust downward quickly enough and wages don't adjust downward quickly enough. And so wages stay high, which makes unemployment high at a time of falling prices and all that. And that's because wage rates tend to be contractual and locked in for 6 months or a year or whatever. And so we have this tendency to say, if only the market could be more flexible. But that is instead an opportunity to instead say, why does the market lock wage rates in? Why does it lock salaries in? Why isn't it super duper flexible? And of course, the reason is nobody would want that kind of flexibility. I mean, who would want his wage to change according to productivity every week? You wouldn't know if you could make your mortgage payment. You couldn't make any long-term plans. So in other words, these anomalies become opportunities for us to understand the market even better rather than to stand in judgment of it.
Okay, but Tom, the last point you made is interesting. With respect to the movie theater, the example you cited there, which is, of course, similar to Thaler's example of the shovels,
right?
You nailed it precisely. But, by the way, you and I both have to say that in the case of the movie theater not jacking up its price, when the huge line and a lot of people are denied the opportunity to see the movie see the movie for the weekend they want to go, it's exactly what we want to say with respect to what price does. A lot of people who are pretty casual about wanting to see the movie that weekend get to go. A lot of people who were really eager to see the film, for whom it would have been a joy, they get shut out because of this quirk of behavior on the part of the movie theater. And similar to the shovel point, the hardware store that thinks it has to keep its reputation, they're denying shovels to people who really need it. And the examples that you and Henderson were very, very, very perceptively citing, which is that are the people going to the hardware store and buying a couple of extra shovels? Are the people going to the movie that night who were just cajoled by their friends who would just as soon not go and would love the excuse that the price is too high? So that's so you and I would agree, wouldn't you now agree with what I just said, that is a kind of a perverse allocation, that the ability of prices to actually allocate desires and tastes is impaired. It's impaired, of course, because the movie theater is marching to a different drummer. But you
right,
and
no,
I wouldn't
I
want
totally
to deny
no,
that
yeah,
point,
no, I
right?
agree that. Yeah, no, I agree. I mean, looking at it from the point of view of the business firm itself, I agree with you that I don't blame them. They want to keep their customers.
Yeah, yeah.
But looking at it from a bird's eye view, I can see that overall, this, you know, this leaves fewer people satisfied, and it's there's less coordination. So, and it makes me want to spread economic knowledge in the same way that people who are happy that price gougers have been cracked down on are just hurting themselves.
That's right.
So I want to go around and tell everybody and explain to the hotel owners, you're doing a great service for mankind by rationing hotel space rationally.
Well, but don't you realize though that when you and Henderson especially, of course, was being very articulate and by the way, talking about the best of both worlds and acknowledging that there are a lot of good Samaritans and altruists who are going to bring in free water, but that doesn't mean that it only helps when people bring in water that they're going to charge for. The point is, when he's talking about all of the advantages of proper allocation by allowing people to charge what the market will bear. The same point applies to that movie theater in the example you cited, or the hardware store. And so my only point is that we are indeed introducing the so-called rationality of pricing when we discuss these matters. But we are acknowledging in a Thaler-esque way that we can't tell this business what to do. Or the movie theater what to do. They feel that in the long run they're going to alienate their customers. By the way, I mean I think that you're getting back to that great debate you had over Hamilton with Michael Malice that you won, or the Hamilton show. I mean, they gave away a fortune to the scalpers, millions of dollars to the scalpers. I think they should have held just an auction every month that people might have regarded as fair. I think there are strategies, but the point is, you see the point though that if you're going to see you and Henderson and me, we're going to say that if you impose price controls, there's going to be misallocations, and people really want it. What prices do is they allocate to people who really want the stuff, and people who are casual about it. The plywood example that you gave, all of that applies to the movie theater as well. So my point is that it's not just that this is interesting about the market. It really is that there is behavior. There are ways in which firms decide that they are going to impose self-imposed price control on what they do. And while it's in the short run, it's not to their interest, and indeed, it's misallocating in the short run. In the long run, it's what they have to do. So don't you see that we are introducing the same kind of quote-unquote rational argument about prices by analyzing this voluntary behavior in the marketplace having to do with what you just said, the one-time theater can charge what the market will bear, whereas the theater that wants to keep a certain benign reputation has to keep a lid on price. But you and I can talk about the consequences of that, which is unfortunate in the short run, because people really want to see the film are denied the opportunity to go. So that's my only point, that there is an aspect of Fowler's argument where when he's saner, he's not lecturing everybody about being rational or irrational. He's simply talking about the quirks of human behavior. And that's where I would say that is perfectly compatible with Austrian school, and it's also rather interesting to talk about. However, when he and by the way, there's no, I would still insist that there's nothing, you and I have no right to object if the Koch brothers, when you read about the firm that they ran, or John Matt, other sort of libertarians who ran companies are really very caring. They do a little bit of nudging. Retailers try to do a little nudging of us. Businesses do nudging in their own interest. All of that happens. That's interesting, and Thaler shed some light on it, but that's in the private sector. There's no way for libertarians to object to it. It's fascinating in its own right. The only way in which we draw the line is when the central power of government gets imposed, and when government starts to nudge, or indeed when Bloomberg, the Bloomberg, who has of course power that nobody should have, starts nudging us in one direction or another. $50 to go to the library, I started to laugh. You know, what are you going to do? Get out, collection of Krugman's books? I mean, who cares? You know, you might be borrowing books that are only going to rot your mind. So why would I want to pay anybody to go to the library? But of course, look, if the Tom Woods philanthropy wants to write checks to people to go to libraries, you know, that's you know, we could say you're foolish, but you know, that's your privilege. You wanted to go to libraries, well, why not? That's fine with me. It's your money. Do what you want with it. It's just when the power of government is imposed on it, that's where I have a problem.
Gene, I'm going to give you 30 seconds because we've only got a few short hours before the event starts.
Okay.
Promote your Soho Forum event in 30 seconds. And if people miss this event, they can go to future events.
Yeah, absolutely. Monday night, I think you're going to be listening to this on a Monday. If you live in the neighborhood, 45 Bleecker Street, downtown, we're going to be debating the merits of affirmative action. Peter Schuck, who interestingly is a progressive who writes books that are gateway drugs for progressives to become libertarians, is going to be arguing against the merits of affirmative action, that it harms the very people it's tried to help. 45 Bleecker Street in downtown Manhattan at 6:30. Doors open at 6:15. Please come. And at some point, I'm going to be having Bob Murphy do a debate because I'm in talks with him. And someday, maybe we'll get Tom Woods to return to the debating ring.
Maybe someday, indeed. We'll see. Gene, thanks. This was a great conversation. I really appreciate it.
Sure. Thank you, Tom. Bye-bye.
All right. Now, before I let you go, I have another unannounced guest, and that is Isaac Morehouse of the Heroic Praxis, which you can find out about at discoverpraxis.com. And as you can see, when you go there or from listening to any of the episodes I've done on Praxis, right there on the front page, it says Apprentice at a Startup. Get a full-time job in 12 months. Start your career now. No degree required. It's an outstanding option for young people who want to avoid the traditional path. This gives them a great opportunity when they're young to get experience that can lead to career advancement way, way ahead of their peers. Isaac, welcome back.
Hey, so Tom, I want to share something with your listeners for a couple of reasons. One, I know you have a lot of homeschoolers in your audience, but it's not just homeschoolers. We love homeschoolers at Praxis, which is why we are doing what I'm about to tell you. But not just homeschoolers, the ones that are Tom Woods listeners are absolutely amazing. You have a high quality, sophisticated audience. And I know this because we get a lot of Praxis applicants, many of whom become Praxis participants, who heard about us on your show. And they are disproportionately amazing, high quality, driven young people. So with that being said, Praxis is offering, we are going to be awarding one full ride scholarship to a homeschooler. So that's the full $11,000 in tuition will be covered. So it'll be zero tuition. And just like everybody else in the Praxis program, you earn just over $14,000 during the program. So for most people, the program pays for itself. For the recipient of this homeschool scholarship, the program is going to more than pay for itself during this 1 year where you've got a 6-month professional boot camp, 6-month paid apprenticeship at a startup. You're going to walk away earning over $14,000. So if you go to discoverpraxis.com/homeschool, everything you need to know is there. You can apply there. The application for this is open until December 31st. So even if you're not going to start the program for as long as a year from now, you can go and apply for that scholarship. So again, this is something if you are, you know, 17, 18, 19, 20, even if you have gone to college already and you're post-college and you were homeschooled, if you're looking to get a jump on your career, you want to get into the real world now, you want to get into a startup and apprentice in roles like sales, marketing, operations, things where you don't need a lot of technical expertise, but you've got that hard work, drive, ambition, and the intelligence that I know Tom Woods listeners have, go to discoverpraxis.com/homeschool, apply for this full ride scholarship. And whether or not you get the scholarship, if you get into the program, you've got the opportunity to participate. But wanted to share that with Tom Woods listeners, especially. Really look forward to hearing from many of you as we do already. And we love it when we do.
All right. So tell us one more time the link they should go to.
discoverpraxis.com/homeschool.
All right, there it is. Well, that sounds great, and I'm really glad you came on to announce that. That's a great opportunity. I'm sure we don't need to describe just how great it is, but I'm thrilled, and I hope we get a whole bunch of responses. And you parents out there listening, think this over, because there are tremendous success stories. You remember when Praxis was a sponsor of the show, and I shared with you from the horse's mouth the testimonies of numerous Praxis participants, and they all had amazing stories, tremendous things to say, great successes, and they had saved themselves a lot of agony and frustration that a lot of people going the traditional route had experienced. So it's definitely, definitely something to think about. Isaac, thanks for taking a few minutes to let people know about this.
Hey, thanks so much, Tom.
All right, everybody, that's going to do it for today. I am on board the Contra Cruise, so I got to get rolling, but I'll see you at some point this week. We're going to do 3 episodes this week because I'm out of town, and one of these days you'll see it pop into your podcast reader. So thanks again. See you soon.
Become a smarter libertarian in just 30 minutes a day. Visit TomWoods.com to subscribe to the show for free, and we'll see you next time.